Today's episode is brought to you by Canby Foursquare Church. Since 1978, a place to grow, connect, and serve. In-person services are back with some restrictions to help ensure everyone stays safe and healthy. For the latest, visit their website at canbyfoursquare.com.
This episode is also brought to you by Chris Salee, your local health markets insurance agency. Creative solutions for your health, Medicare, and life insurance needs. Personalized advice at 503-678-5768. Welcome to the Canby Now podcast,
your source for news.
The threat of a possible teacher strike was avoided this week.
There's a new irresistibly cute creature winning over fans, and its name is Scootaloo.
Sports?
It's like Lucy in the football. You want to kick a field goal, but they take it away from you.
We had to learn how to win.
Goal can't be in the last second of the game!
And interesting conversations.
Because I'm one of the strongest girls ever, and I know that for a fact.
I just really enjoy writing gossip as if I was a bear.
With an old maid daughter that make the best moonshine in the coast.
And if it would have hit me in the face, I think I would have died. I really do.
I guarantee you would have died, man. Are you kidding me? The city of Canby has announced three finalists to replace former city administrator Scott McClure, who was terminated in February after barely 4 months on the job. Officially dismissed for no cause, McClure left with 6 months' salary and benefits pursuant to his contract. The decision to terminate him had followed a meeting in executive session and was 5-1, with only Councillor Tracy Hensley voting against his dismissal. No reason was given. To replace him, the city is reusing the same executive search firm that landed them McClure, Peckham & McKinney, a highly regarded outfit that agreed to conduct a new recruitment process at no additional charge except direct expenses. A nationwide search yielded 75 applicants, significantly more than the first go-round, which have been winnowed down to three finalists the city announced on Wednesday. Scott Archer, who is the current director of the North Clackamas Parks and Recreation District, Brian Bosshart, most recently the city administrator of Bedford, Texas, and Randy Robertson, currently the city administrator of Aberdeen, Maryland. For a more complete look at the three men's bios, find this story on our website, canbynowpod.com. The three candidates will be in Canby on Tuesday, August 18th, for a series of interviews as well as a socially distanced meet and greet at Waite Park. The candidates will be interviewed by panels of elected officials, community stakeholders, and staff in the afternoon, followed by a bus tour of the city. The meet and greet will be held from 6 to 8 p.m. and will include the candidates' spouses or partners. Masks will be required for all attendees if the social distancing guidelines cannot be met. Each candidate will be provided 10 minutes to speak from the gazebo for an introduction and an opportunity to answer one or two questions. Following introductions, candidates will be socially distanced at certain areas to meet members of the public. Comment cards will be available for feedback, and staff is working with Canby CTV Channel 5 to live stream the event on Facebook. Canby City Council is scheduled to meet in closed session at City Hall immediately following the meet and greet event. During a time when Canby residents are feeling more isolated than ever, a group of committed volunteers are seeking to bring the community together through the power of fiction. Modeled after a successful program that has been held in Lake Oswego for many years, Canby's community reading program will involve a group of more than 100 residents sharing in the experience of reading the same book at the same time. The book is This House of Sky, author Ivan Doiga's 1978 memoir reflecting on his early life in Montana. Canby Library Board member Linda Warwick says she believes the book will resonate with many in Canby. It's a memoir, but also a book about landscape. and it spoke to me really clearly about how important the place we come from is in our lives, Warwick told the Can Be Now podcast. I thought it would be especially apt in this moment when we are all more confined than we are accustomed to, and the place we find ourselves in is the only thing we really have to explore. Starting August 17th, the books will be available at a handful of businesses throughout the community, including the Book Nook, Retro Revival, Gwen's Coffee House, and Wayward Sandwiches. Additional books will be available at the Canby Public Library. They're free to anyone who would like to participate. Over the course of 4 weeks, readers will be asked to respond to thought-provoking questions and send in their responses with pictures, if they wish, to the library. These will be printed and posted in the windows of the Canby Public Library to share with the community. We're pretty isolated right now, all of us, in this moment, Warwick said. Almost all of us are living alone, in our own skins, a lot more than we're used to. I think it's an opportunity for people to share life experiences with others in the community, even though it's not face-to-face. If we can share life stories, even through the windows, we're going to have interconnectedness. The program was developed with Library Programming Coordinator Hannah Hofer and with support and funding from the nonprofit Friends of the Canby Public Library, and is intended to replace some of the in-person adult educational programming the group normally puts on throughout the year. Canby Area Transit is known for moving hundreds of riders throughout the community each week and back and forth between neighboring cities as well. But CAT itself could soon be moving to a new permanent home at the city shop at the end of North Redwood Street, presuming the financial considerations pencil out. CAT is currently headquartered at an office building on Hazeldale Way next to Wilco, which it leases. Last year, a nearby one-acre parcel became available and CAT pounced on it with the goal of building a new headquarters. But new transit director Todd Wood told the city council in a work session last week that it may not be the best site for a permanent home. The location, while convenient and easy to access for the public, is small and would require some creative security solutions because of the close proximity to neighboring properties. CAT's fleet of buses, currently at 13 but expected to grow to 18 later this month, is already cramped at their current digs. The main downside, though, is that the mechanics who service the fleet are based at the city shop on the other side of town. So, Wood said, anytime we have a bus issue, they have to come pick it up and take it back to the shop. That takes a lot of their time. Even simple repairs like replacing a headlight or a windshield wiper or routine maintenance are complicated by the need to either shuttle a bus over to the shop or bring a city mechanic out to the bus yard for a site visit. The shop is on a 5.5-acre property owned by the city, which also serves as the base of operations for wastewater, public works, and other city departments, as well as the Canby Utility Board. The Cub contingent, though, will soon be brought back into the fold at the utility's new headquarters on Southeast 3rd Avenue, opening up some space. Though this property also presents some downsides, most notably the lack of public access, Wood believes this may be made up for by the benefits of having the mechanics and fleet technicians on site. Staff said that public-facing CAT operations, such as the sale of bus passes or sharing of information about routes, could probably be relocated to City Hall and the Canby Public Library. The shop property would have to be reworked to accommodate the bus fleet and transit operations. More engineering work would be needed to determine how much this might cost. This could be offset by being able to put the Hazeldale property back on the market, funds that would go back into the CAT's budget once it's sold. No decision was made or expected last Wednesday, but counselors gave the nod for staff to continue their cost-benefit analysis of such a move for later consideration. GOP lawmakers were quick to criticize the lack of public involvement as the Oregon legislature's second short session of the summer was gaveled to a close shortly before midnight Monday. In one long day of work, legislators were successful in rebalancing a state budget wrecked by the devastating impact of the coronavirus economic crisis, as well as strengthening new laws passed earlier this year to further limit the use of chokeholds and other use of force measures by police. But Republicans, among them Canby State Representative Christine Drazen, decried what they called a lack of transparency and public access to the lawmaking process due to COVID-19 restrictions. At the end of the day, our budget is balanced, but Democrats made the unprecedented decision to deny access to Oregonians, not even allowing for remote public testimony, Drazen, the House Republican leader, said in a statement. The lack of public access to this process is unacceptable, and the people of Oregon deserve better. Senate Republican leader Fred Girard also took Democrats to task for what he termed their locking Oregonians out of the legislative process. This is the building of the people, and it is wrong for the supermajority party to continue to lock Oregonians out of the legislative process, he said. It is a symbiotic relationship. Oregonians have a right to be involved in the creation of legislation, and legislators need their input and advocacy to craft sound policies for the state. While not directly responding to the claims of the process lacking public involvement, Governor Kate Brown praised lawmakers for their quick work in addressing the estimated $2 billion shortfall while preserving important services for vulnerable populations. I'd like to thank legislative leadership and every member of the legislature for carrying out the serious work of the second special session I have called during this pandemic, she said. While we may not agree on all the details, I appreciate that lawmakers protected critical state services, including schools, healthcare, and senior services, while also taking action to tighten belts in state government. She preserved her criticism for the federal government, specifically the Trump administration and Republicans in Congress, whom she blamed for the failure to pass a second coronavirus relief package. Without direct support from Congress to fill the gap caused by COVID-19, the governor said, our budget reserves will quickly run dry, and we will have to make impossible choices next year when it comes time to pass a budget for the next biennium. The smash hit musical Hamilton has inspired millions of Americans with its fresh and earnest reimagining of the country's founding, and particularly since the streaming service Disney Plus brought it to new audiences this summer, its catchy tunes have also inspired numerous parodies. The latest comes to us from 91 school principal Skylar Rodolph, who dressed up in royal garb to share his parody of You'll Be Back, which in the original musical is a sort of breakup song from King George to the American colonies in the style of a British invasion band. Yeah, if you haven't seen it, Hamilton is as weird as it is amazing. In Rodolph's version, the song offers a hopeful message to students and families as they prepare for a fall semester that will take place against the continuing backdrop of the coronavirus pandemic. Rodolph's YouTube channel has been a must-watch for 91 families since March, featuring epic joke battles with other principals, fair warning the dad jokes are strong with this one, as well as educational videos such as his Math on the Farm series. This has been very deliberate, as Rodolph tells the Can Be Now podcast, humor is a big part of who he is, and to him, trying to bring laughter and joy is just a part of supporting and caring for district families. Especially during difficult times, we need more joy and laughter, he says. It is a way I can share a piece of who I am with my community. As an educator, I am in the people business and the kid business. I miss our staff, I miss our students, and I miss our families. I feel a bit more connected this way. 91 has done parody videos before, like last year's Read Me Maybe, a spin on the somewhat less literary-minded Carly Rae Jepsen hit. Adding the Lin-Manuel Miranda masterpiece to his repertoire has been in the back of Rodolph's mind since he first saw Hamilton a month ago. The administrator admits he has zero stage or vocal experience, but he subscribes to the theory of fake it till you make it. I would not classify myself as a good or confident singer, but I went for it, he says. Fortunately, good technology, a little auto-tuning, and lots of singing Hamilton made it bearable. Rodolph's delightful ditty is more than bearable and even manages to avoid the soggier moments that made Jonathan Groff's original performance both memorable and memeable. Rodolph, quote, tried to get the slobber but still can't quite figure out how he does that. And now, without further ado, here's Skylar. Rodolph, take it away, Your Highness.
You say you dislike the learning that we put you all through in May. You cried, don't make us do that again in the fall or we just might die. I know you're sad, but we worked all summer trying to meet the governor's guidelines. Now she's changing what we had. It's okay despite all the changes, we have a plan. You'll be back soon, you'll see. Try to remember how school used to be. You'll be back, time will tell. Just remember that we can teach kids well. COVID cases rise, we need them to fall. If we're gonna be in person at all. But if push comes to shove, we'll stay in connected at home learning and be sure to get it done. Da 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 da. You say that COVID's draining and you can't go. It is gone, and you will learn your subjects, 'cause they're all important subjects. Math is such a hard, hard subject, but you'll do all the other subjects ever, ever, and ever, and ever, and ever. Not like before, you'll have to wear a mask walking through the door. 6 feet apart, wash your hands. Those are just some of our safety plans. So get online, join a Zoom, and you'll get used to your new classroom. And when push comes to shove, we'll do whatever it takes to teach you. Because you're the ones we love. Da 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 da.
Hey, Frankie, do you ever wonder why some businesses aren't, like, more transparent?
Oh, yeah. Like, some of the old buildings downtown are so dark. Get some more windows,
no,
you know?
No, no. I mean, like, transparent as in being open and honest about their business practices.
Oh.
Yeah. Like, DirectLink is a good example. They don't have internet data caps or charge extra fees for high usage.
Oh, yeah. Which is great with all the internet I've been using since this whole COVID situation started.
They also don't charge infrastructure build fees like some other providers. And they're active in our community, too. Check out their philanthropic efforts at directlink.coop/community.
Did you know that they also hold an annual meeting every year where members can talk directly with the board of directors and upper management?
Talk about transparent. You won't see any other companies being that accessible. DirectLink really is here for us. Call 503-266-8111 or visit directlink.coop to learn more today.
Well, joining us on the Camby Conversation today is Mayor Brian Hodson. He's the mayor of Camby, and he's been doing a lot of research recently into the long planned and finally, apparently on the way, tolling proposals for Interstate 205 and possibly I-5. Hi, Mayor.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. How have you been doing in these crazy times?
Keeping it together, trying to, keep the ends from getting too frayed, but, all in all, pretty well.
Yeah. Yeah. You've been doing a really good job. I know that it's, I guess we've been hearing a lot from you. You've been doing, obviously the city council and the meetings that you, already do, as well as quite a bit of outreach through the COVID, not weekly anymore, but at one point weekly meetings. And, I guess if nothing else, you definitely don't feel, boring or not needed as an elected official in crazy times like this, huh?
The big piece, is entering month six of all this is trying to, provide, new information, which there isn't a lot of new. So now it's more about just trying to be encouraging and trying to, encourage everyone to reach out to loved ones as much as you can and check on your neighbors and maybe stop, fighting a lot more or stop fighting a lot less out there in the greater scheme of things.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely changed the feel of the crisis from the early days, right? Like initially, it was maybe a little easier to get on board. It was, we were all kind of feeling difficult things. We were all, people were losing their jobs. There was a lot of crazy stuff going on. Now we're in this phase of, we've all kind of woken up to the fact that it's not a sprint. This is going to be a marathon, and it's not quite as easy to summon some of that goodwill or, sometimes the frustrations just come out. I mean, like you said, we're in month six and we're only human, right?
Yeah. Frank, it is. There's still that, is it real? Is it not? Is it made up? Is it not? The mass piece legit? Is it not? Like, there's still a lot of that back and forth and whatnot. And does it help? Does it not help? I mean, so, there's that piece of it. Then you get down to the granular pieces of, open more or not, or roll back or not, right? And so a lot of conversation, because I get the numbers every day, and as you know, and I think many people probably listening to this know, that Washington County, Multnomah County, Clackamas County, there's a couple of us that are all kind of fairly often in the breakdown, Clackamas County usually is in the low 20s per day, right, with new, confirmed or cases.
Yeah.
Whereas Multnomah is, anywhere from 80 to, I think I saw 110 recently on a day. And then Washington County is, 45 to 65, depending on the day, right? And so, if you're in Clackamas County, and even rural Clackamas County, like Estacada or Sandy, you're kind of like, okay, like, why are we still shut down? Like, we're single digit, kind of a thing. And so that's become a bigger challenge. I know the Board of County Commissioners for Clackamas have been, trying to lobby the governor to rethink that whole regional approach. And so we're trying to support that as well, but then it's a balance. I mean, there's still a great number of people that think that yes, open up. But then there's still a great number of people that are like, no, don't open up. Like, let's, we need to just continue to be locked down and clear this. And
yeah.
So, yeah, it's a constant battle, right? And I've got a really, I get to be part of a really good team that is looking at the information and looking at the trends and looking at the numbers and, you know, it's the fog of war. Like, what's the way to go? We lift it, go against the grain, and deal with the consequences, or toe the line, do the best we can, and face the consequences of that. Right? I mean, there's consequences either way you shave it, right? And so,
yeah,
being an elected official right now, a councilor, a mayor, a county commissioner, whatever, it's challenging with what's going on.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this might be more of a controversial position, but I almost feel like I'm over phase two at this point. Like, things have changed and the lines have gotten so blurred. Like, the governor's office is now, you know, backed off the curfew thing for restaurants and bars. So now it's 10 p.m., you know, statewide, regardless of phases. The gatherings are now statewide, like gathering sizes and restrictions, regardless. It's like, what do you even get to move on to phase two? It's like pools, I guess. Like, I don't even know what we would get.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know what a new phase two looks like right now. What is that?
Like, you know, the kids playing sports, like, they'd be able to share equipment and share balls, but that's all been pushed back to January anyway. I don't really know what we get. Like,
yeah, I mean, that's a great question, and I think that needs to be reestablished out of the governor's office to say, we're here, you know, because we've inched some ways into phase two, but not totally. Not enough to call it phase two, but we're still not totally ready to say we're out of phase one.
Well, just, I mean, like, are we going to do this county by county, or are we doing it as a state? Like, it made sense to kind of, I thought, to approach it county by county, and then the numbers started to go up, and in a lot of ways, she kind of went back to, okay, we're doing all these things as a state. And so we kind of got the whiplash. So it's like, yeah, let's do one or the other. Let's kind of try and be consistent with what makes the most sense for Oregon. But we're here to talk about different frustrations, Mayor. Not
yeah,
about coronavirus,
let's talk
about that. But speaking of frustrating things that can bring out lots of different opinions, how about tolling on the interstates?
Let's talk about, well, and it's the interesting thing, Frank, you can call it tolling, you can call it a user fee,
mm-hmm.
you can call it congestion pricing. You can.
I like congestion pricing.
There's a couple of other names I think that they've interwoven in this conversation.
Uh-huh.
Much like when you talk about housing, you've got affordable housing, workforce housing, housing equity. That was a big term for a little while there. So, yeah, there's a couple of different names, but for this conversation, we'll refer to it as tolling.
Okay. I'm going to try to think up some more euphemisms as well. I think that would be fun. Like,
okay.
Like a mandatory ODOT tip. How about that?
I like that one. I might have to use that at my next meeting. I think I've got one next week.
You can use that, man. That's for you.
You're not going to trademark that?
No, I will, but you've got an exclusive license. So it's been in the works for some time, yeah? Or at least been talked about.
So the tolling piece, so I sit on, I'm the chair to the Clackamas County Coordinating Committee, which is a group just strictly Clackamas County, and it's made up of mayors, city councilors in urban and rural cities, and there's representatives from the hamlets and CPOs, and then from other, like the fire and water districts and things like that. So that particular committee looks strictly at land use and transportation issues. So we talked about it there.
Do you guys not call it C4 anymore?
Well, we do call it C4, but so the Clackamas County Coordinating Committee.
Okay.
And every county has a coordinating committee that meets each one's charter is different. Ours in Clackamas is housing and transportation. Then I also sit on a committee for the Area Commission on Transportation for Region 1. So that is ODOT, and ODOT is broken up into various regions throughout the state, and these area transportation commissions. And so I sit on that committee as well. And so that committee has been talking about this now, probably was introduced, I would say probably a year ago, year and a half.
Okay.
And so you figure by the time it came to us in that capacity, ODOT, the state, they were probably talking about it. I'll say a year before we even started talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
So this has been probably, 2 years in the works, but a year and a half of real serious conversation.
Yeah. I guess I really want to, in this conversation and in talking to you, focus less on kind of the regional approach or yet less on maybe what the state hopes to do with the proposal and really laser in on how it might affect Canby. I know that that's a lot of the concerns that you have, that I know that you've heard from people. And when this came up at city council last week, that a number of the councilors had as well, is how it would affect Canby, especially in terms of, potentially forcing more traffic through 99E, but maybe there are other impacts as well.
So the scope of this is that the proposal is to put, they're called gantries, polling booths. So basically, there's five different plans that are being looked at right now for various tolling gantries along I-205. And so that's the big conversation is, like, where are those going to go? What's the fee going to be? What's the timeline? All those kinds of things at that level. So a third committee that I sit on just on this topic is one of, it's a diversion committee, because we know, and I've always said it, I'll continue to say it, I believe that traffic is like water, and it's about finding the path of least resistance. And so if you're going to put on a user fee, a high volume tax on using I-205, people will get off of 205 and find a way around the tolling. So this diversion, so that's the diversion piece, right? So this diversion committee that I'm a part of with a couple of the other mayors that are along 205 have been meeting with some of our city staff members and talking about this. And so our last meeting, we got into what is that impact going to look like if people divert from I-205.
Yeah.
And 99E, they believe, will see a significant impact from 205 to as far down as Woodburn. Because people will go around 205 to get tied back into I-5 going south if they want to live, work, and play in the Salem area.
Have they engineered it to the point where they have an estimate for, like, how much it would increase traffic that we would see day-to-day through Canby?
They've not run those computer, and that's the thing, computer models.
Yeah.
Now, I have been the mayor now 8 years, been on the council for 10, and I think I have yet to see a computer model as it relates to car counts and transportation that have actually held true to form.
Right.
So I'm very leery of the quote-unquote computer models and what they'll tell us.
Yeah.
So this last diversionary meeting, like, they put it, we shared some maps, and I need to bring that to the next city council meeting. But the pieces that they're looking at that will have increased traffic, so Highway 99, McLaughlin, Highway 43, 211, 214, so these other highways that pull away or go around I-205. And so now here's the piece that was interesting, because when this whole conversation started, the original understanding was that it was the tolling was going to help pay for I-205 and
right.
the expansion of the Abernathy Bridge, the additional lane,
yeah.
etc. Well, that conversation changed almost 9 months ago, maybe not even that long, where it became about the tolling is going to happen, but the tolling is now going to pay for the installation of the gantries and the tolling pieces, and now this the diversionary upgrade that'll need to happen in certain areas because of the traffic that will come off the freeway.
That's just like, well, that's right. The best.
You chuckle, and I scratch my head going, okay, wait a second. And so I grew up in the Midwest.
We're putting in a toll to pay for the toll.
Well, and there's always that piece, right? Like, well, you know, we got to pay for the infrastructure
right.
first, and then we can do all these other things.
Right.
And it'll be great, and there'll be all this new stuff. Well, ODOT and our state government has shown time and time again that we plan a project, and by the time it's done, it's already, the capacity is greater than what was built, and it's absolutely antiquated once it's completed.
Yeah.
Because we don't think that we're going to grow as much as we end up growing, and the computer model was wrong.
Yeah.
Again, hence my hesitation on following the computer model. So, and getting into the conversation about what the diversionary piece is going to look like, so 99 is definitely a major, already a major thoroughfare, and it will just increase.
Always has, you know, no one's like, oh, that's a great idea. Like, everyone hates it. But that's kind of, to a certain extent, you can be like, oh, you know, that's Facebook, that's social media or whatever. But I remember when this came up at City Council last week, Council President Tim Dale, among other councilors, but Tim Dale in particular, you know, tends to be pretty even keeled, pretty logical in his approach to things, obviously has tons of experience. And even his quote was something just like about how afraid he is of this thing happening and how he thinks it's going to be really devastating for Canby if it does go through, which kind of raised my eyebrows. I guess, can you talk about that a little bit, about just the deep concern that you and some of our other leaders do have about, you know, really the impact that this will have on us?
Well, like I said, the traffic is an impact, but the other piece I think that is a bigger concern is the financial impact.
Sure.
So, we know, and we've talked about it a number of times, that we've, you know, 70-80% of those that work in, that have, are employed in Canby, leave Canby to go to work. Now,
yeah.
This is obviously pre-pandemic, right? But, so that's a lot of people leaving our town and in the morning and coming home, and you look at the greater numbers of Clackamas County, a lot of Clackamas County, I think the number is 70% of Clackamas County residents that are employed and work for companies in Multnomah County and Washington County. So, where who's picking up this tab the most is the residents of Clackamas County, and we're one of those. We're one of those cities.
Yeah.
So I really worry about the financial impact that it will have on a lot of the families here in Canby. You know, so yeah. What is that? You know, am I adjusting now my work schedule to leave at 5 o'clock so I don't have to hit that window of paying $3, $4? I mean, I don't know. They haven't told us yet what that would look like. And then am I, you know, will my job allow me to flex my schedule to, you know, come in at 6 and leave at 2? I don't know. That may not be conducive to my job. So I'm paying a heftier fee. Or as you called it, the ODOT tip, to come home and make it home for, you know, my kid's activity that after school at 5 or 6 o'clock.
Yeah.
You know, I those are pieces that to me, are a big concern.
Yeah.
And they've not been able to assuage those fears or those concerns for me in this project. Now, and again, my understanding of tolling, and this is the federal side of things, is that you can toll if you're putting in new lanes or new freeway.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, they're talking about tolling an existing highway, the whole thing, not just the new lane, the whole thing.
Right.
And so that to me is also inherently, I think, wrong in this whole process.
Well, now that we're all depressed and angry, in the next couple of minutes...
Really wound up.
I know. Is there any idea that you have from all your dozens of committees that you serve on centered around this issue of what's coming next? There's currently a survey open that ODOT is doing, as you mentioned, Brian, those 5 alternatives that they've devised for the tolling options on 205. We'll include a link on the show notes to this episode so folks can check that out if you haven't already. But just in terms of kind of, do we have timelines? Do we have an idea of what will happen with that survey data and kind of where we go from here?
So, yeah, that's it. Yes, there is timelines. ODOT's very good about creating timelines. So right now, yes, there is a survey available go in. Please click the link if you put it in the article. I appreciate that. Go give your feedback to ODOT. They're doing that piece. At the outset, they're going through what's called the NEPA process, which is really the environmental study of the project. So that's currently about to get underway or is underway. And then I think they've got planned another survey down the road, but we're looking at, finalization of this and whatnot will start to occur or in 2021, and we could probably see this going into action in 2022.
Wow. And I guess we can just hope that it'll just get delayed like highway projects tend to do, huh?
Well, you know, so frankly, that's kind of one of the things is like my last meeting, I went in and asked the question right out of the gate was, okay, is this a foregone conclusion? Like, this,
yeah.
Is this going to happen? Because if it's going to happen and there's nothing, no stopping and jumping up and down that I can do to stop this, I need to know that.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
Then it becomes about how do I make this less sucky?
Right.
Is basically what it had boiled down to.
Yeah.
And so right now it seems to me that it's about trying to make this less sucky is unfortunately I think where this is at right now.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping that it doesn't pencil out and that we find other ways. The challenge is cars are becoming more fuel efficient, so the gas tax revenue is not what it once was. We've got, month 6 of a pandemic where we is probably at two-thirds of what we had on the road. And so, you know, that's exact tax revenue. We had years of questionable use of road funds that's not there for, you know, significant projects.
Yeah.
Vehicle registration fees. Now each county is layering in their own to be able to deal with their own transportation concerns and challenges. I mean, even in Canby, right? We have a 3 cent gas tax. We have a $5, you know, road maintenance fee that we pay to just take care of our own roads
because right.
what was coming from the state wasn't enough, wasn't keeping up.
Yeah.
So, so is there a different way to approach it? I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. And that's why they may just be like, this is the solution we think is the right way to go, and we're going to go.
Yeah.
This is one of those, like, it's an ongoing challenge.
Yeah. Well, Brian, we really appreciate you taking the time out to tell us about this. Again, all this depressing news. If nothing else, at least I do think you have a new campaign slogan, Brian Hodson trying to make things less sucky.
Well, I might play on that one a little bit. See, you know,
yeah,
we can
workshop it.
We'll workshop it. How about that?
All right, man. We just got to pick out a good font. I think it'll work. All right. Thanks, Brian. Appreciate you.
Thanks, Frank. Yeah, I appreciate it.
Joining us now is Donna Ellison of Ellison Team Homes, a firm serving all across the Portland metro area with three realtors based right here in Canby. Donna, can you tell us how Ellison Team Homes started?
I started in real estate. I grew up with my dad. He was a realtor. Mm-hmm. So I'm a second generation broker, and I grew up with him on weekends. And I learned a lot eventually working with him for several years and then going out on my own. Our family moved to Canby a couple of years ago, but we really didn't know how it was going to go. And within the first probably 3 months of being here, we literally fell head over heels in love with this place. We love the community, the spirit here. The first Christmas at Waite Park, I was literally crying because everybody was walking around saying Merry Christmas and people were drinking hot chocolate and we got in a carriage ride with the horse and it was just too much. You just realize it's special here. Real estate's always been my passion. It is my professional love. I enjoy the people, the relationships. So much comes out of kind of the intensity that you spend with people. You're really up in their business for a period of time. And sometimes it's a couple months, sometimes it's a couple years, sometimes it's a lifetime.
Yeah.
I feel very blessed at this point to have people that have been with me for almost my entire career. Mm-hmm. Clients that have bought and sold maybe 2, 3, 4, or 5 homes. I have one client that's bought and sold 8 homes with me.
Yeah.
3 generations. It's a beautiful business. It makes for a very full life. Mm-hmm.
How can people find you?
How can they not, really? we have a website, www.ellisonteamhomes.com.
Well, thank you, Donna.
Thank you for having me.
Canby Then is brought to you by The Book Nook, Canby's amazing local bookstore and gift shop. It is your source for new and used books, comic books, audiobooks, vintage books, well, all things books. You get the idea. They're across from the Backstop Bar and Grill in downtown Canby. And of course, as always, please support our unique and locally owned businesses as much as you can during this difficult time, especially businesses like The Book Nook. Well, when Governor Kate Brown ordered statewide school closures last month, it was not the first time in Canby history that schools were closed to fight the effects of a global pandemic. It was actually the second. It also happened in October 1918 as the world was reeling from the impacts of history's deadliest epidemic, a strain of H1N1 more commonly known as the Spanish flu. Schools were closed on Wednesday morning, October 23, 1918, by the order of Canby Mayor W.H. Baer, who was acting on instructions from the state health officer, Robert E. Holt, Holt was, in turn, taking his cue from the Surgeon General of the United States, who had, quote, directed that all public meetings as well as schools and theaters be closed forthwith to combat the worldwide epidemic of Spanish influenza, which is what the Canby Herald recorded. The schools, and particularly the toilets, maybe they ran out of toilet paper too, were to be thoroughly cleaned with formaldehyde and chloride of lime and fumigated. Where the disease originated was unknown, but because newspapers in Spain had been the first to cover it, it was dubbed the Spanish influenza, or Spanish flu for short. The first wave of the 1918 pandemic occurred in the early spring and was generally mild. The sick, who experienced such typical flu symptoms as chills, fever, and fatigue, usually recovered after several days, and the number of reported deaths was low. However, a second and highly contagious wave of the influenza appeared with a vengeance in the fall of that same year. Victims died within hours or days of developing symptoms, their skin turning blue and their lungs filling with fluid that caused them to suffocate. From the start of the year 1918 to the end, the average life expectancy in America plummeted by a dozen years. The symptoms started with a fever, like the common cold. Unlike measles or smallpox, there were no outward signs of the infection. As the sickness intensified, so did the pain. Patients would cough blood and start to turn blue from a lack of oxygen. A lethal type of pneumonia set in and caused an uncontrollable hemorrhaging that filled the lungs, leaving victims to drown in their own blood. Young victims and the elderly were vulnerable, but what was baffling about this new strand of the flu virus was how it struck otherwise healthy young men and women in the prime of their lives. These were the same boys the nation was sending to Europe to fight in World War I, and as such, the disease spread quickly among troops who were housed in barracks and traveled in close quarters. The first cases of the disease in Canby were reported the same week that the schools were shuttered. Two sons of a local man named William Earle were taken ill, their ages unknown. These first two were soon followed by a large number of new cases that appeared across the city and Clackamas County and quickly spread. Though it's not known if he was the first, one early flu victim in Canby was a young man, Herbert Johnson, who died at the Vancouver Barracks Hospital in Washington, where the area's first cases and from the second wave of the pandemic were treated. Johnson, whose age was not listed in the obituary in the Oregonian, died on November 7, 1918, barely 3 weeks after he had left home to enlist in the military service. He left behind two brothers, Ernest and Al Johnson. His remains were returned home, where internment will probably be at Canby, the obituary read. There was another recorded death that happened in Canby even earlier in the pandemic. It was also caused by the flu, albeit in a very different way. Ernest Perkins, 31, of West Lynn, was killed after being struck by a southbound train on the Southern Pacific tracks in Canby one early morning in October 1918. He was on his way to Salem to attend the funeral of a friend, John Bush, who had died from the influenza. At the point where the accident occurred, the road parallels the track for some distance, turning sharply at the crossing, the Oregonian reported. It is believed that Mr. Perkins was wholly unaware of the train coming behind him. The world, it could also be said, was wholly unaware of the train coming behind it. The Spanish flu infected a third of the world's population and killed at least 50 million people worldwide, 675,000 of them in the U.S. It was one of the deadliest events in human history. For a long, brutal fall and winter, the nation suffered. Then, on the morning of March 13, 1919, some good news finally came. The America had returned to port in New York City. The ship with the famed 13th Aero Squadron attached to it had left on December 4, 1917, bound for the battlefields of Europe. Its troops had been engaged in the Meuse-Argonne Offensive and the Battle of Saint-Mihiel and helped see the Allied powers through to a victorious end. "We worked behind the lines, but near the front most of the time," said the squad's color sergeant, Stuart McCrae of Salem. Many of the squad's members were from Oregon. "But there is an excitement even at that. At night, we used to hide in shell holes and dugouts, and there were many nights that Fritz came out and bombed us." Fritz, of course, was a World War I era nickname for German soldiers. The Arrow's mission was to engage and clear enemy aircraft from the skies and provide escort and reconnaissance and bombardment squadrons over enemy territory. It also attacked enemy observation balloons, performed close air support and tactical bombing attacks, and even provided mechanical support and rescue in the heat of battle. When a plane is brought down in no man's land or gets out of order there, we are the boys who go out to fix it, said Arthur Savage of Grants Pass. And let me tell you, Fitz can snipe and shoot some. The squad was highly decorated for its service. Following the November 11th armistice of 1918, it was ordered back to the United States to be demobilized. The America's journey home, however, did not go as planned. In cramped and poorly ventilated conditions, an outbreak of the deadly flu took hold. The virus infected 105 men, at least four of whom died. The heroic work of Army surgeons, including Lieutenant W.A. Neal from Portland, saved countless lives and eventually brought the outbreak under control. The America docked, and its soldiers were transferred to Camp Mills in New Jersey for sanitation quarantine. On board was a boy from Canby and two from Morgan City. They had survived the mustard gas of the Aragon and the horrors of the Spanish flu. And they were going home.
Hey, Frankie, you okay? You seem kind of down.
Yeah, I'm just bummed. I miss going to the Wild Hare. I know you can still get takeout and all, but it's just not the same.
You know they're open again, right?
What?
Yeah, they've been open for a while now. Don't you cover, like, the news?
Hey, I'm only human, okay?
Okay. Well, I can tell you that the Wild Hare and their amazing staff are thrilled to be open again for delicious meals and fun times. They are strictly following all the recommended safety guidelines, and they have the only covered outdoor patio in Canby, with lots of tables spaced 6 feet apart and umbrellas also spaced 6 feet apart, and fantastic ambiance. And hey, if you're still more comfortable with carryout, they can hook you up there too. Find their menu and other information online at thewildhairsaloon.net or check them out in Canby and Oregon City. Anything to add, Frankie? Frankie? Oh, I guess he left. God, he must have been really hungry. The Canby Now podcast is produced by me, Tyler Clausen. Our content director and star reporter is Tyler Frankie. We also feature the vocal talents of Joy Struby and James Walden, so round of applause to them. The song that you're hearing right now is Canby by singer-songwriter Olivia Harms, used with her permission. Find more of her work at olivia13.com.
The Canby Now podcast is dedicated to preserving independent local journalism and redefining local news with our fun, fresh, and energetic brand of storytelling. Our sincere thanks to our local sponsors who make this show possible. Please show your appreciation by supporting the small businesses who support us.
The Canby Now podcast is a production of Now Hear This Studios, Canby's locally owned full-service audio, video, and media production company. Our mission is to produce the best content in the universe, and we'd love to help you do it. Find us online at nhtstudios.com.
I will take a motion to adjourn.
I just moved it.
I didn't even ask for it, though.